Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome everybody to Paranexus Universe. This is your host, Doug Kelly. It is Thursday, March 5th, 2009. Good to have everybody here with me and with my co-host, Grant. Hey, Grant.
Hey, everybody. It's nice to be here and happy Thursday night.
Yeah. So let's start out with a little bit of an updating on things, and then we'll get into John Siebel, our guest. He's going to be with us here shortly. I just wanted to mention that the new Journal of Anomalous Sciences is out and available, the March and April issue, and Yari has put that whole thing together. I sent it out in the newsletter today, and it's on the site, the Paranexus site at paranexus.org, and he did an awesome job. I mean, I can't even say enough about it. He's got a really dynamite web viewer attached to it, and tons of pictures, very, very, very professionally set up. I mean, it's just, he did an awesome, awesome job, amazing job. So be sure to go to paranexus.org and check out the new Journal of Anomalous Sciences. And just by way of explanation, we've been doing the Paranexus Journal and so forth, and I had been kind of spearheading that over the last few months and so forth with help from Retta Akamatsu, who's now helping Yari on that. And so as a way of basically simplifying some different things, Yari has taken over full responsibility for the journal under the sister organization of World Nexus Publications, and I'm going and have been basically driving Paranexus as the executive director. So we're still working together very tightly. We're just now sister organizations. And again, he and Red have just done an outstanding, amazing job on that journal. I can't say enough about it. It just, I was impressed. He did a great job. So be sure to read that. And if you're not a member of Paranexus, we'd love to have you as a member. So go to paranexus.org and check it out there. We are rolling out, as I've been talking over the last few weeks, the Paranexus Field Investigator Program. It's much closer right now. Mike Jones, our technical development manager, and I are working on the database, a new registry database, which will allow people to not only submit investigation requests, but also for our members to submit sighting reports and so forth for the Paranexus field investigators to have access to update reports. It's really a great program, and it's coming along. And we'll be rolling that out in phases. Probably in the next week or two will be the first phase, so look for that. And without any further ado, let's bring in our guest. We, as you always know, we can take questions in the chat room. We can take questions on the phone. If you'd like to call in, I'll put the number in the chat room as well. It's 347-945-7799. And tonight we have a guest coming back. He was with us, I believe it was last July. June, July, right, last summer. Anyway, John Siebel, he's a cultural anthropologist, historical archaeologist, actor, and ghost excavator. He has been participating in and supervising field investigations since high school. He has conducted archaeological research in England, Germany, Mexico, and the United States. He's done ethnographic fieldwork in Chiapas State and in the Yucatan, Mexico. He has appeared in more than 25 films, including Dune, Conan the Destroyer, Rambo, Falcon and the Snowman, and the James Bond classic License to Kill. He has also appeared in numerous TV series, documentaries, and educational TV. He has taught cultural anthropology in the Graduate School of the University of Guadalajara in Mexico and in various colleges in Mexico City. He's conducted ghost excavations in Winchester, England, and the United States at Gettysburg, Eastern State in Philadelphia, Rolling Hills in New York, throughout Pennsylvania and various other locations. John, welcome back to Paranexus Universe.
Nice to be back. Back here in cold and very, very snowy Pennsylvania. How's it down there?
Oh, it's been cold here.
Oh, it is cold?
Bitterly cold, John. You don't want to know. You'd be afraid to know.
Bitterly cold, that must mean it probably didn't get below 60.
Matter of fact, it did. It got down
to the
30s here, but today's been nice. Today we're right back up and supposed to be nice in the weekend, around in the 80s. So.
Well, on this show, we're going to talk about a little change in attitude and change in latitude.
All right.
About ghost research. A little Jimmy Buffett here.
All right.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah. Well, tell us what you've been doing lately.
Well, what I've been doing, I just got a call, like I said, today. I'll be going out and doing some work for a show on TV. It's coming up, going down to Gettysburg, so I'll be doing some work on that. I just finished up three more books, so they should be coming out very, very shortly. One is based on my idea of ghost archaeology, which I will get into shortly, but it's based on six different case studies that I've done, Eastern State Penitentiary, a couple in Gettysburg, a couple here in Pennsylvania in the coal region, one down in Petersburg, Virginia. And so it's sort of like my theory and my idea put to practice in these case studies. And the one following that I'm just finishing up now, sending it to the publisher, is going to be called Phantom Gettysburg, Alternative Histories of a Battlefield. And this is going to finally, I hope, lay to rest the idea that Gettysburg is acre for acre the most haunted battlefield in the world. I say it isn't at all.
Wow. That's a pretty strong statement, John.
Yes, well, the book will show you why. We'll tell you why.
Give us a little teaser.
A little teaser. Well, I go into about 35, 40 different things, and I talk about why, if Gettysburg is haunted, we should have specific manifestations occurring on the battlefield, not this sporadic idea of about, well, you hear, I think we hear gunfire, or I think I hear somebody movement in the brush, or I think there is a shadow person over there, or I had an encounter when an individual who walked up to me and said, hey, take a picture over there, or something like that. Well, if we're talking about what really happened in 1863, none of those things are applicable to what happened in 1863. I mean, it was just so horrendous and so horrible that these things are what people imagine they think might have happened in 1863, but I go into the idea of the culture of war and what the idea of the culture of war was in 1863, the idea of the philosophy and the cultural values of the soldier, both North and South, regarding ideas about death and what happens after you die, ideas about the importance of soundscape to a Confederate soldier as opposed to a Union soldier, and the implications of that. So I use all of these different concepts. I apply them to what people say is happening at Gettysburg, and I apply that to what they say is happening to what the culture in mid-19th century was during the Civil War, and they are just not compatible at all.
What do you think is the biggest misconception that folks have about the battlefield being haunted?
What I think is people, when they go there, they have an idea about what happened at Gettysburg in 1863. But their concept of what happened in Gettysburg in 1863 is based largely on what is occurring in Gettysburg 2009. You have the reenactors going in there. You have the cross-cultural dressers walking around. You have a very, very blasé, mundane, not very, very emotional manifestations that are happening today. You have the ghost walks, and these ghost walks are very, very subjectively manufactured. It's geared to inducing people to accept that whatever is occurring in a place that they never visited before, any kind of anomalous manifestation or sound or anything like that has to be from paranormal, because prior to that, other people experienced that same thing, and this is a haunted location, according to these people. So what happens in that location has to be also related to an anomalous haunted behavior. So it's sort of like an involutionary thing. They go in there and say, okay, we're going to tell you stories about what happened in this place. This is the equipment a person could use to detect things happening in this place. So they go there and, okay, go out and explore, use our equipment, and listen to the stories that we told you. So they're not accustomed to the sound bites of that place. They're not accustomed to the acoustics. They're not accustomed to the visuals of this place. So anything that happens automatically gets directed towards something as, oh, it has to be a part of a haunting phenomenon because it happened before. People say it happens here, so they are induced to believing that anything that happens that they can't explain automatically.
So they've already come with preconceived notions
into
a place where there are people there that are going to exploit that for profit.
Right, right. And my whole idea is that, if there are ghosts at Gettysburg, we shouldn't be enslaving them. We should be releasing them, not enslaving them. So the people who are organizing all of this ghost tourism enterprises are actually, if they believe in what they're trying to promote, then they are actually enslaving these ghosts there because they don't want them to disappear because they lose their business.
When you think of the sheer magnitude, John, of the casualties and the size of that battle, in your experience, and I'm just playing kind of devil's advocate here, has there ever been a spot on the battlefield, aside from all of these places that have become popularized, that you think might have some legitimate residual activity?
Well, now I'm talking about two different things. I do believe there is a lot of residual energy at Gettysburg. I'm specifically talking about interactive presence. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe there is any interactive presence in Gettysburg. There is residual energy at Gettysburg, but that's related to the environmental conditions on the battlefield, the amount of the geological formations that are there that create high EMF and things like that. So you're seeing things that are actually environmentally induced. I've seen some really unbelievable images. I have some friends who took some stuff in Devil's Den, and he's shooting up toward the top of Devil's Den, and out of the wall comes this Confederate soldier walking up the hill. I mean, it's perfect. It's this full body apparition, but that's residual energy because a live person was standing next to this person. And, of course, he didn't see this other – the ghost didn't see this live person, so that was a residual energy. So,
right.
We have to differentiate between residual energy and interactive presence. And people always say, well, we had 51,000 casualties at Gettysburg, therefore there must be ghosts. Well, if we look at what happened during World War One on the battlefields of Verdun, we had – over 1 million casualties.
That's right.
There is one or two sightings of a ghost at Verdun. So we have 1 million versus 51,000. And the other thing is, like, we have these like Travel America, and they say, well, they talk to individuals who have written books about Gettysburg ghosts, and I won't name any names, but these individuals say, well, I will list you the top 10 haunted places on the Gettysburg battlefield. And one of the places of the top 10 that's listed is this person's headquarters on Baltimore Street. Okay, well, that's fine. That's listed as number 7. But if you look at where the deadliest casualties occurred at Gettysburg, number one, where they had 6,600 casualties, were the fields of Pickett's Charge. Yet the fields of Pickett's Charge was the most deadliest battle area engaged at Gettysburg, yet that does not make the top 10 list of the most haunted sites at Gettysburg.
It's probably too big, John. It's too much of an area for... You probably want to keep those folks that come in there with those preconceived notions and are looking, looking for an intelligent type of haunting. And if folks are telling them it's going to occur, you can keep them in a pretty close proximity in like if you have a house or you have a smaller field. But, you know, I'm imagining that those fields where Pickett's Charge was conducted on are acres wide. You have people wandering all over the place.
There are certain areas like that. For example, you have the Bliss Farm, which is right along that battle line there. There have been reports of a lot of EVPs being conducted there and being recorded there. You have also some interactive presences there at the Bliss Farm. So, but this is not listed as one of the most haunted sites. I mean, there are various pockets within Pickett's Charge, you know, in the fields of Pickett's Charge where you would pick up a lot of these things. My whole thing is that when people go out and ghost hunt on the Gettysburg battlefield, they just go and do a general survey, and whatever they get, they get. I have a specific strategy geared to a ghost archaeological approach that I use, for example, called the COCOA, K-O-C-O-A, which was the military terrain strategy that was used by Meade and Lee at Gettysburg. And COCOA, K-O-C-O-A, stands for Key Area, K-O stands for Observation Area, C stands for Cover and Concealment Area, O stands for Obstacle Area, and A stands for Avenue of Approach. So, if you look at it from the point of view of 1863, in a cover and concealment area, you should not find any interactive presences, because people did not die in a cover and concealment area. But you would find some residual energy there because they're waiting to go into battle. So you might get some EVP there, or you might get some residual energy of people, a smell of tobacco, smell of coffee or something like that. But as opposed to an avenue of approach, which was along a major battle line, a major engagement line, there, if there are any interactive presences, it would be in an avenue of approach as opposed to a cover and concealment. But people just go out on the battlefield, scan the battlefield, take their photos, do their measuring, do their scanning, and see what they come up with. And it's just not very, very scientifically measured in that way. So I look at it from a military terrain strategy that was used during the battle. Using that military terrain strategy, where on a battlefield would you have an interactive presence, or where would you have a residual presence?
Well, for the benefit of our audience, John, I think it is a fascinating title. For the benefit of the audience who may not be familiar with your works, yeah, Tell us a little bit about what is ghost archaeology.
Okay.
Define it for us, please.
What I'm doing is I'm looking at the other side of ghost research. This other side is a change in attitude and a change in latitude. Now, the first change in attitude is I'm not looking at a site as a haunted location, but I'm looking at a site as a haunted cultural personal space. Okay, so I define a haunting as the area of a haunted cultural space. And this haunted cultural personal space goes back to, do you know of, or you've heard of the Rhine Institute, right? Okay. Now, Dr. Rhine, way back in the 30s, this is a great quote. Dr. Rhine said, "Our object is not to try to prove survival after death. Rather, it is to discover how far personality is independent of physics and where that interrelationship really takes us when followed up." So what I try to do is I try to follow up this idea of personality over physics, personality, cultural perspective, the other side of ghost research, as opposed to the physics, the physical side, the anomalies, the measuring and recording of EMF, the measuring and recording of temperature variations. So what I'm trying to look at is the cultural aspect, the other side of ghost research. And I also look at the past in a change of latitude. I look at this haunted cultural personal space vertically rather than horizontally. So what I think is occurring in this haunted cultural personal space is a symmetry of various things that are occurring in the same space. It's symmetrical, it's percolating, it's unfolding, and it's occurring in the same space as opposed to a contemporary physical space. So the cultural aspect of it is I try to unearth and engage in this physical cultural space rather than measure and watch. So I'm using techniques to unearth a presence in a particular space using cultural artifacts, cultural performances, trying to unearth what's going on in there, rather than sitting back and taking measurements and waiting for something to happen, setting up my DVR, recording in a space. So I'm directly engaging, directly trying to unearth. A horizontal approach is a focus on presence, okay? It's a physical scientific approach that emphasizes detection using scientific instruments. Is there high EMF in this area? Did it go up? Did it go down? Where is it? That's the physical detection of presence. A vertical approach, on the other hand, is concerned with absence rather than presence. I tried the whole idea is communication, okay? And the investigator is the principal tool of communication with an interactive entity. So I use a vertical approach as opposed to a horizontal approach. I use the other side of ghost research, a cultural approach rather than a physical approach. And I developed this idea of ghost archaeology. And ghost archaeology has two characteristics. One is you have to have an archaeological sensitivity, and you have to have an archaeological imagination. The archaeological sensitivity asks, how do we engage the remains of the past? And when I talk about the remains of the past, I'm talking about interactive ghosts. And an archaeological imagination is what is the transforming practice or the performative practice that we can do in the field to encounter what is left over of that past? So you have an archaeological sensitivity, we have an archaeological imagination. That is ghost archaeology. And of that, we have five different components. But if you want to ask something, or you want to talk about
good.
So if a person is knowledgeable of those two factors, does
right.
that facilitate communication?
I think so. And I'm going to tell you exactly how I do it, okay? Because see, I'm using all my background knowledge. I'm using my acting ability. So I'm trying to act out these cultural activities that a ghost, if he is, for example, a Civil War soldier, would resonate with that ghost, bring back memories of that ghost by doing resonating characteristics. So a ghost archaeology has, for example, I say it has five components as I develop it. The first component is a particular sense of place, and that particular sense of place is a haunted, cultural, personal space. And this haunted cultural personal space is vertical, not horizontal. It goes down deep. It goes down various levels. So we have to unearth it. But to unearth it, we have to do performative cultural activities to bring out what's there vertically. So when I think of the past, I think of a past that's unfolding, fragmented, symmetrical, percolating, and multi-layered past. So we need to excavate, to unearth what's in that vertical dimension of space. The second idea is, how is the relationships going on in this haunted cultural personal space? What is the relationship between the space and event? For example, this happened here. Okay, what happened here? And what happened here is largely a mundane, habitual, cultural activity. There's nothing supernatural about it, nothing paranormal about it. It's mundane activities that if there is an interactive ghost, it's repeating these mundane habitual activities, or in the case of a battlefield like Gettysburg, he's repeating what would be called the culture of war, what he does on a battlefield. And what he does on a battlefield is not what people say they see on the Gettysburg battlefield. Individuals walking around with no blood on them, with no putrefying smell of decay, no arms dangling off. They don't march in drills on the battlefield like people say they see. Like, this is, again, the whole idea. This is not what happened in 1863. So we have this particular, this happened here. So the idea is, what happened here is, if something happened here, we have to understand the culture of what happened there. So then we have various possibilities of what could occur or what could manifest. And these are what I call haunting uncertainties. Based on these haunting uncertainties, I excavate. This is a non-evasive excavation. I use different performative activities to try to resonate with a memory of a ghost in that particular space. So I do various activities. I don't know which activities are going to work or which activities are not going to work, because this is human behavior that is still there, so we cannot predict human behavior. So I have to do various different rehearsals, various different activities, record everything that I'm doing in this frame of reference, in this personal space, and then go back to that and see, well, what worked and what didn't work. What works, then I develop into a profile, a stratigraphy of profiles that identifies certain behavioral characteristics that occurred while I was doing these rehearsals, while I was doing these performances. And then I develop a script and redo it again to see if it repeats itself.
Interesting.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, we touched on that the last summer when we talked, acting out the part, which I thought was really an interesting approach.
That goes with that. Now, part of all of these components of this particular cultural side and this idea of a vertical dimension rather than a horizontal dimension is, I have five principles that I use when I do my excavation, non-evasive excavation. And, excuse me, the first thing is, I use a scientific practice that is based on histories. Not history, but histories. And what these histories are is, I'm trying to develop a relationship of meaning. When I do something out there in that frame, in that personal space, when I do something, I'm trying to resonate with the memory of I'm going after interactive entities. You know, residual things are totally different. I'm trying to go after an interactive entity. So I'm trying to develop a communicative relationship with this that has meaning to the memory of this ghost. So I'm trying to develop a history with that individual ghost. So I'm not interested necessarily in properties or environmental characteristics, high or low EMF, temperature fluctuations. We are recording those in the initial survey, but once we got those hot spots located, then we go into the excavation part. And we try to develop these histories through these rehearsals, trying to unearth certain behavioral characteristics to come out. So I'm out there doing these rehearsals. The camera, the equipment is there in the periphery, out of range of where I am, and everything is focused on me, but it's recording everything I do in that frame to see, well, Is there a manifestation when I do one thing, or isn't there?
Can you illustrate for the audience what would be composed of in rehearsal?
So, for example, in Gettysburg, there is the famous Jeremy haunting. Jeremy was a little boy who was supposedly killed on Baltimore Street. He was playing tag with other friends. You run out in a horse and carriage. You run out, you tag the horse and run back, and whoever was the fastest won. Well, he ran out. His carriage was coming down. He turned to go back to the pavement. He slipped. He was trampled by the horses. His father took him upstairs to the Sarah Black room in the Farnsworth house on Baltimore Street. He lingered for a day or two, and then he died. He is said to haunt the Farnsworth house, the Holman house across the street, and still another house, too. So I got a friend who is a clairvoyant medium who worked in the Holman house across from the Farnsworth house, and she says, well, yeah, Jeremy comes here all the time. And I says, yeah, sure. Well, let's see if he does. So what I decided to do is, okay, getting all the characteristics of what people say Jeremy is, when he lived. We're talking about a small boy in the late or mid 19th century. What would be, what type of activities would a boy of that age like? What would induce him to manifest? You know, so I got these set of marbles. I got different types of poems and music and toys, but trying to just set an atmosphere for him. And what I really did to really get him to come out was I tried to recreate how he died without the trauma of him reliving that death. So what I did was I got an old a copy of a book and the illustrations of Black Beauty, which was written in the 1850s, 1860s, cut out various illustrations of horses. I put these horses in various spots where he is supposed to manifest and where the clairvoyant medium told me this is where he comes through. So I put these horses and carriage in these various spots, and then I would tell a story. I would say, Jeremy, we're going to play a little game. I would name names of individuals who lived in this house, and name names. So we're going to say Jimmy Smith and Bobby Jones. We're going to play this game, and the game is we're going to play a game of tag. What you have to do is you have to go, and when I count to three, you're going to go and tag the horse wherever the horse is located. So I had preset cameras in all of these strategic places where I set these illustrations from a 19th century book and placed them there. So in the playback of the video, you could hear me going through all these instructions. You could hear me telling Jeremy different things, naming the names, playing some music, doing some other things. And there's nothing being recorded in this one area where we had placed this drawing of this horse. Nothing's manifesting, nothing's occurring, nothing unusual. Then you could hear me in the background saying, Jeremy, at the count of three, you're going to go and tag that horse and come back to me. So you could hear all of this, and then you could hear me say, one, two, and before I get to three, in this frame, this orb just appears. The orb appears and just starts moving through the frame and stops right where the drawing of the horse is. It lingers there for about 5 or 6 seconds and then just disappears. Now, how do we explain that?
That's interesting.
Now, it happened more than once. I tried to duplicate the idea using something else. I did it. I let it pass for 2 weeks. Then I got a set of marbles and I did the same thing. I said, Jeremy, we're going to play a little game of marbles, because marbles was very, very popular at that time. So I got these cat-eye marbles. I got them from this company that are duplicates of original marbles from 100 years ago, and I started playing marbles. In that same area where this orb manifested, I got another camera there focused on that. It was like in a hallway going up toward the stairs. I had an investigator in there with an EMF meter and a flashlight. That's all he had. I was looking through a doorway directly at that stairs, and I had two motion detectors on that doorway, and I was in the front room looking straight at the stairs through that doorway where the motion detectors were, through where the camera was and where the investigator was. I started playing marbles. All of a sudden, I heard, doo, 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 doo. The investigator's EMF started to spike. And all of a sudden, he said, my flashlight just went dead. So this is the sequence. It happened, boom, 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 boom. I was playing marbles. The EMF spiked in the stairways. His battery drained. Boop, 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 boop. The motion detector goes off, and I'm looking right at the door, and there's nobody going through the door. Then all of a sudden, in the room where I'm playing marbles, that EMF meter that was being held by another investigator started to spike too, and the clairvoyant medium said, Jeremy just came through the door. He's looking at you playing marbles. He's sitting right down there where you're playing marbles and watching you play with the marbles. We took some photographs, 35-millimeter digital photographs. When we looked at the photographs afterwards, there was an orb between my finger and the group of marbles. So we had that sequence.
There was a what between your?
An orb.
Oh, okay.
A nice, round orb between my thumb, where I had the one glass-eyed marble, and the group of marbles that I was going to, you know, hit. So there was an orb right in three different photos from three different angles. An orb. So,
hey, John, I just a question comes to mind.
Yeah.
Do you think that when people have died in a very traumatic manner, as a lot of those heroic guys did in the Civil War, that regardless of their cultural beliefs and foundations, that just by the very nature of the trauma, that they might be confused?
Well, first of all, we have to accept the idea that they didn't...
If you accept the premise of an afterlife.
No. We first initially have to accept the idea that when they were in the battle, they didn't think they were going to die. And I can't accept that, especially a Civil War battle. When they were going into battle, they knew they had a good chance of dying. And a lot of these people in these books say, well, they didn't know they were going to die. And they died so suddenly they weren't aware that they died. I can't believe that. Because if you look at what a Civil War battle was, you knew you had a very, very good chance of dying.
Yeah.
I can't accept that idea that, well, they died too fast. And
not like a car wreck.
Confused. Yeah.
Well, see, I respectfully disagree, because if you're walking into a whole line of canister, you'd be out like a light. You'd be literally, people, you know, and there's been testimony, eyewitness testimony, people just disintegrating. So,
right.
I mean, you know, those folks may not have known, or they may have blacked out before that. They certainly knew that something was coming, and it wasn't going to be good.
But, okay, but what are we talking about here? Are we talking about what's going to occur in that frame?
Well, the reason why I brought it up was because one of the key points that you brought up was the fact that you thought that based on their cultural beliefs,
right,
that they wouldn't hang around, that
right,
they would be gone, that they would ascend, or that those cultural beliefs would propel them into some sort of their concept of an afterlife. And so I just wonder, you know, and I'm just playing kind of devil's advocate. If you know, the popular theory is with ghosts sometimes, if they've had a traumatic death, that they really don't realize that they're dead, or that they're confused afterwards, and that's why they tend to hang around.
Okay.
And so with the trauma, so much trauma there, it leads me to wonder.
Okay. I'll accept that premise. Now you're going to have to accept what follows. Okay. If we accept that they got confused, that they didn't know they were suddenly killed, okay? So they were kind of in a liminal state there, you know, betwixt and between, okay? So okay, then we have to accept what happens next, okay? So what happens next, if they're still lingering around and they don't know they're dead, their behavior has to be based on their culture of what happens next. It has to be based on the memory of how they live their life. Would you agree?
Absolutely.
Okay. So if we accept that premise, that first initial premise, we have to accept the second premise of that culture, the importance of culture and the memory of that culture. So we still run into the problem with that at Gettysburg, these people are seeing these soldiers walking around like nothing happened, like they're on a tour or like they're just helping tourists to take the right photographs. These are what these people are reporting, seeing ghostly presences with that type of behavior. That type of behavior, even for a ghost who doesn't know he's dead, would not act that way.
Yeah, it's absolutely inconsistent with
right.
their cultural background and what they've been raised to believe culturally. So the whole, but what I guess, let me just kind of redefine that. In those instances, let's step away from all the hoopla and the flashing lights and the ringing bells and everything else that we know makes money for people in Gettysburg. And really, in my personal opinion, is a disgrace, okay, to those guys. But let's step away from that, and let's say in some obscure area of the battlefield where you feel that there has been activity, with some of those perhaps intelligent hauntings that might occur, have you seen examples or have you seen any of the spirits or whatever they may be that may have stuck around because they are confused or their last frame of reference was with a guy who was standing next to him who also might have been killed?
Well, for example, you might not even see the guy standing next to you because of the intense smoke, for one thing.
Absolutely.
But I can tell you one thing. Like I like to go into the woods on the eastern slopes of Little Round Top, down into the woods below the 20th Main Monument, down to the Company B marker, down to the Stone Wall. That's where the 15th Alabama came up through.
They took a bad lick in there.
And they got slaughtered. They were at the verge of retreating and Chamberlain ordered to charge, so they charged back down that hill, the 15th Alabama, and they ran right into the Company B of the 20th Maine and 2nd Pennsylvania sharpshooters, and they were really hit hard.
Yeah.
So I do a lot of things in there. In fact, I did one on October 10th. Most Haunted was in Gettysburg at that time, and they were in the Farnsworth house, but I was on in the woods by the 20th Maine with the 15th Alabama doing my thing, and I had a reporter from Pittsburgh with me, and I took her out in the afternoon, and I says, okay, this is what we're going to do. We're going to do all these scenarios, five or six different scenarios. We're going to play music. We're going to have live person singing. My friend was going to sing. She's a great singer. She was going to sing, and we're going to see if we can induce something to happen. And she says, well, yeah, okay, no problem. I'm not afraid of anything. Nothing's going to happen. The only thing I'm afraid of is a bear. I said, well, there's no bears here. Don't worry about that. Oh, okay, I'm not going to have any problem. So, okay, we'll see what happens. So now it's dark. Of course, you know, battlefield didn't close down yet, so I didn't go there after hours. But we were there, and it was dark, and we broke up into groups of two, and I took her out into the woods, and I started to do some Colonel Oates speech and some commands, and I used some vocabulary that the soldiers would identify with, and we would walk a certain distance. I'd turn off all the flashlights, and we'd just sit there, and she started seeing shadows and movements and stuff like that, but she was still okay. So we're doing this, and the others were taking photographs, and we're doing all these different things. On the way back down through the path, I'm about 5 feet in front of her, with a flashlight, she's walking behind me. All of a sudden, well, it was a female scream, okay?
That's close, John.
Come on, scream like a girl, schoolgirl.
She screamed, and I turned around and I said, what happened? I said, I've just been touched. I mean, my head and my shoulders and my arms have been touched. I said, well, okay. I said, you're female. They wouldn't touch me. I mean, these guys were 3-day march, 28 hours without any water, So, and you see a female in the woods? Yeah, yeah. Every time I take a female out there to that section of the woods, they always get touched. Now, what touches them, I still don't know. But something touches them, and it's not an animal. Every time. So you're saying, yeah. And that is definitely cultural behavior.
If you're looking at it from their frame of reference, okay, what's a woman doing out in that battlefield? I mean, we know that after the battles, they came out on the battlefield to tend to the wounded.
Right.
But during the course of the battle, there should not be a woman on the field.
I know, but I do that purposely to bring a woman out there.
Absolutely, which would probably blow their minds.
Exactly, because they're traumatized as it is. I mean, that was an engagement back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. You know, and then all of a sudden they see a woman out there walking leisurely on the battlefield.
Yeah.
I mean, they're going to go up and touch her.
Let me just ask you a question. I've never had the privilege of being at the bottom of Little Round Top. How much of an incline? Because, as you're well aware of, John, and our audience may not be well aware of, that was in the middle of July. And if you know anything about the accoutrements and the uniforms that those soldiers wore, they wore wool and cotton blend. And those guys ran up that hill all day long.
Right. They're going back and forth, back and forth. Well, it's very difficult to judge now because the whole structure of that place has changed, because they at one time at the early 20th century, they had a road called the Chamberlain Road there, and they had to dig up a lot of that side of the hill. And so there's a lot of displacement of different things. But the large stones are still there. Now, in those large stone areas, that's what I call cover and concealment areas, where they, for example, if they're advancing up, they could hide there, and wait and not get shot at. Well, they get shot at, but they wouldn't get hit. So I tried to do a lot of EVP in those areas, and we were getting something in there. I talk about Alabama. I talk about different individuals. I did a roll call, and I would name the names of
those.
Oh, that's
a great idea.
Yeah,
that's a great idea.
Of those that were killed on that spot. But I didn't only name the names that were killed. I was naming other names that survived to see if I would get a reaction either way, sort of like a null hypothesis, I should get a reaction from a dead person, but I shouldn't get a reaction from a live person who survived the battle. So I was doing testing both of them. So I was doing that, and the last thing I did there was what I always do. I give a Colonel Oates speech about, this is the last command. I'm giving you your last command. The fight is over. It's time to go home. And that's what I always do in an investigation. I always say it's time to go home. I try to cross them over.
Yeah, and of course, for the benefit of our audience who may not know anything about Colonel Oates, he lost his brother there.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, he lost his brother there. And what I did was I focused on Company G. His brother was in Company G, and Colonel Oates was the captain in Company G before he became the commander.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the men who died in the 15th Alabama were from Company G. What's even more significant, I call them the Band of Brothers, because there was 47 members of Company G that were brothers. And ten of them were three brothers together, and like 12 of them were like, or whatever it came out, that were like two brothers. And so I focused on Company G throughout that whole engagement, all those performances I was doing, just because I thought that would be a better focus, because, they were the ones that died the most in that area. They were pretty solidarity, because they were brothers, so some of the brothers died, some didn't. Colonel Oates was in that company, and he died. I mean, not Colonel Oates' brother was in that company. He died, but he didn't die there. He lingered. What's interesting, he lingered until, like, July 26th.
Oh, what a shame.
When he died back in Alabama, his mother woke up in the middle of the night and said, "My son just died." Now, I tried to do some research to find out if that was a crisis apparition, because I also was interested in that. Were there any crisis apparitions occurring of all of those people that died in that battle? Were there crisis apparitions? Did they go back home and tell their relatives one final goodbye. And I'm trying to research that now to see if there are crisis apparitions appearing in the homeland, you know. But
That's fascinating stuff.
Yeah.
And you know, the thing that brings to mind is, you know, if our audience isn't familiar with Shelby Foote, and I know you are, John.
Yeah.
Shelby Foote wrote three great books on the Civil War. And one of the quotes that he made was in the book, and I think it also came out in Ken Burns, was the fact that, and we're talking about the culture here. The culture at the time was these guys all lived in the same hometown, or they were all from the same county, and they all signed up together so that you might have been in a company with a judge from your town or a grocer or a doctor or whatever, and so you knew everybody. So the downside to that is if you got in a sticky situation, everybody just kind of plowed ahead. And the sorry thing about it was a lot of times they thought that they were put in a situation where they couldn't leave. They didn't want to run because, you know, everybody in your town, if you went back, knew you were a coward. So a lot of them died. In many towns, no young men came back.
Right, right. That's like I said. That's why I focused on the Company G, why I focused on the 15th Alabama, because I knew everybody that died there. I knew the names. I knew what they did. I knew where the town where they came from, and they were a band of brothers. So I used all of those elements, and I tried to integrate it into these, like, six different scenarios. And I created a scenario where it would be a Colonel Oates speech at the beginning saying, well, we're going to go into battle, and I know you're tired and stuff like that. And I was using expressions that they would understand, not only from the Civil War slang, but from Alabama as well. Then I would develop into different things, like the exact words that I would use as a colonel to order my men to charge up that hill. Then I would go to the cover and concealment area and talk to them about life in Alabama, see if I can get some EVPs. I would talk about the lack of, I know you guys need water, you boys need water because they lacked water, and they sent a whole bunch of men to look for water, and they were captured, so they never came back. So I used that. Then I had my friend sing Somebody's Darling, which was a really popular song. I did some poetry from a survivor of the 15th Alabama. I read the poetry, and I did that, and I would do pauses between these various scenarios and just keep on. I had a stationary camera, video camera, that was recording all the time, all these movements, as well as the mobile cameras that were following us around as we were doing these different activities. So I was doing double recordings to you know, compensate one for the other. But what's interesting is behind that stone wall, going further east, that is away from Little Round Top, that is a very, very strange area. There's all kind of weird stuff going on back there. I think that's where they came up from Big Round Top and came up around that area up there. And it's sort of like a depression area down there. It goes down maybe about 5 or 6 feet. So they would be able to be covered there. They might have got together there, and that's when they organized to attack. So there's something there. And every time we go there, when we're sitting by a stone wall, we hear all kind of noises in the back there, behind us, further east, away from Little Round Top. So that's one thing we're going to continue doing, and investigating back there. I have all these different. Every time I go up there, I try to do a different scenario, different activities, and just keep building up this what I call stratigraphy of profiles. What works? What doesn't work? If it works, develop it into this script, what I call a ghost script, and then try to be reiterative and repeat it, so I know I'm on the right track. So it's a lot of work. It's excavating. You're unearthing what works, what behavioral characteristics you're getting. It's a lot of work. I lose people all the time because they said, I don't want to do this. This is too much work. All I want to do is go out in the battlefield and take pictures.
Yeah.
You know?
John, tell us about your books again and your website. Yeah, tell us to talk about those. We've got about 5 minutes left or so.
Okay. Well, the new book is called, listen to this title, it's called Bodies of Substance, Fragments of Memories, and Archaeological Sensitivity to Ghostly Presence. Does that sound
good? Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And what it is it introduces ghost archaeology, which I really didn't get into too much, but we can do this another time. But anyway, I got into this ghost archaeology introductory, and then I got into six specific case studies. And the first, there's like three case studies that deal with ethnic behavior. One is the anthracite miner working in the mines and the coal mines, and I talk about the hauntings in the bars in this local area and the row houses. Do you know what a row house is?
You bet.
I don't.
Yeah, row houses. You know, like it's one continuous block of houses. There's no separation between the houses.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's how it is in this area. So I talked about how that affects hauntings. Then I talked about the ethnic behavior of the Irish, and I focused on the Yingling Mansion. Now, the Yingling Mansion was owned by the Yingling family, who owned the Yingling Brewery, which is the oldest brewery in the United States.
Amen. Good beer, too.
Yeah.
And we went there, and we were doing there was a little girl. She was supposed to haunt. An Irish maid also was helping her, so I was doing some Irish things to try to induce these to come out, so I focused on that. Then I focused also on Jeremy and the Pennsylvania Germans in the book. On another one, I focused on the cultural behavior of soundscapes and how it affects the Southern soldier, and what I did in Petersburg, Virginia, when I went down there to do a investigation for Paranormal State. There was a haunting of a Civil War soldier, so I thought drums were very, very important, because every time the boy would play the drums, he would see a soldier.
Mm.
So I kind of start playing the drums and see if I can induce the soldier to come out, and I talk all about the importance of the soundscape in that section. I talked about Eastern State Penitentiary and nonverbal behavior at Eastern State Penitentiary, because for the first 100 years, silence was golden in Eastern State. You could not talk or you were really got tortured. So I talked about that in relationship to hauntings, the prison culture at Eastern State. So that's in that book. Then in the book I just finished writing now, it talks about Gettysburg. It's called Phantom Gettysburg. And I look at it from the perspective of the culture of war and the mid-19th century belief system on death and dying, which is totally different than what the ghost lore of Gettysburg talks about. It's just totally different. So I focused on those things. And it all involves the idea of crossover. Now, according to Earl Hess, who wrote various books on the Civil War and Civil War soldiers in battle, he mentions the idea of soldiers crossed over in battle. Now, it's not that they died in battle, but their experience crossed them over, that experience made them different than the people back home, because the people back home could never experience what they had experienced in battle. So according to Earl Hess, that was a crossover. And so I used that idea of crossover, that the soldiers they crossed over in battle, which made it easier for them to cross over in death.
Okay, so your website, where is that?
Well, I have a new website. It was originally www.ghostexcavator.com. Now it's www.theghostexcavator.com. And then I have my other website. You have it on your website. It's HTTP, my Verizon, but that's on there. In that Verizon one, it sort of talks about my my research, where I'm gonna be working, some other sites of interest. And in the other one, www.theghostexcavator.com, there's a blog portion there, and that specifically focuses on my books.
Okay. Well, great. Well, again, interesting stuff. Appreciate you coming back on, and maybe we'll have you on again. We're not too distant.
Yeah, we can talk.
Yeah, it's a very interesting perspective, John, on how to conduct investigations.
Mm-hmm. It is. Now, next week, we have another interesting guest to join us. We're going to be talking about the Dulce Base, fact or fiction, and probably get into some Area 51 stuff as well with Norio Hayakawa. Hope I'm pronouncing that name properly, but we'll be looking forward to him next week on our program. And just an FYI, we have made a pretty much a permanent change to the program. Instead of going 2 hours, we're going an hour, And we do have some spillover time when necessary. So just FYI, the show is about an hour or so long from now on. If you know of an interesting guest you'd like to have on the show, we'd love to hear from you. Just shoot us an email. And you can send it to admin@paranexus.org. That would be just fine. We appreciate everyone tuning in to us each week. And, John, we really appreciate you coming back. Appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Awesome. Thanks for having me on again.
Yeah, always a pleasure talking to you, and I wish you well and all the stuff you're doing there.
Yep, and there's plenty to share about the Civil War, so there's always room to have you back again, John.
I really enjoyed it.
I have a lot of stuff.
Well, great. Shoot us an email. We'll get you scheduled again down the road.
Okay, no problem.
And again, that's it for another week on Paranexus Universe. Again, thanks everyone for listening in. We hope you have a great week, and hopefully you'll join us next week. Good night, everybody.
Everybody have a safe weekend. Bye-bye, everyone.
It's Paranexus Universe.